Welcome to Studio Tulsa on Health. I'm John Schumann, sitting in for Rich Fisher. Native Americans in Oklahoma have health outcomes worse than the rest of us in an already low health-attaining state. 42% of Oklahoma's Native Americans are obese, compared with only a third of the general population. The diabetes rate for Native Americans is 50% higher than it is for the non-Native population. One likely reason for these disparities is that Native American communities often have minimal access to healthy foods, relying on convenience stores rather than full-service groceries. Convenience stores usually lack fresh produce, resulting in their communities being what public health experts refer to as food deserts. My guest today, Valerie Bluebird Jernigan, is a public health researcher, advocate, and filmmaker who has grant funding from the National Institutes of Health and the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, among others, that address these disparities in Native American health. Her work using documentary film as a medium to improve public health is a unique skill set that marries art and science in a creative synthesis achieving measurable impact. Jernigan is an assistant professor of public health at the University of Oklahoma. She's based here in Tulsa, where her main current work is centered around a multifaceted intervention to bring healthier food to both Choctaw and Chickasaw Nation convenience stores. She uses a method known as community-based participatory research to achieve her aims, a technique praised for its inclusion of the study population in the design and implementation of the research. In addition, she uses film to guide tribes in implementing changes in their food and physical activity environments. Valerie Bluebird Jernigan is our guest today on Studio Tulsa on Health. Valerie Bluebird Jernigan, welcome to Studio Tulsa on Health. I want to start with your current work and maybe work backwards. So tell me what Thrive is, your NIH-funded project. That's the National Institutes of Health. And congratulations, because those are very difficult grants to get, especially nowadays in the age of the sequester. So what does Thrive stand for, and what are you hoping to accomplish?
Thrive stands for Tribal Health and Resilience in Vulnerable Environments. And Thrive is a five-year National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute-funded randomized trial of healthy makeovers in tribally owned convenience stores in the Choctaw and Chickasaw Nations of Oklahoma.
So it sounds good. What's the intervention then? It's a randomized trial. So are you going to provide healthier foods in some convenience stores while the others are what we'd call standard of care, i.e., you know, leave them the way they are?
Yes, so that's exactly what we plan to do. So the Choctaw and Chickasaw Nations both own these. They're really actually really beautiful. They're very newly constructed, most of them, and they are strategically located throughout the tribal nations. And the convenience stores, I guess you would say, are sort of the typical convenience store kind of environment. They sell what you would expect to find in convenience stores, primarily high-fat, high-calorie foods. And some of them have smoke shops, so you can actually drive in and do a drive-through and purchase cigarettes. Some of them have fast food restaurants attached to them or hot food available for purchase inside the convenience stores. So these are actually one of the business endeavors that the tribes have embarked upon more recently as a way to kind of branch out from just casinos. And so our plan is to randomize these stores and to implement healthy food makeovers, so increasing vegetables and fruits that are being offered there, product placement and promotion, selling the vegetables and fruits at prices that tribal members can afford, offering coupons, those sorts of strategies to help hopefully increase vegetable and fruit consumption among tribal members. We know that a lot of these areas are very rural, and so a lot of the tribal members, our pilot data shows us, actually shop at these convenience stores and purchase their main foods are purchased there. It represents their main food purchasing store. And so rather than maybe drive to a Walmart that's 60 miles away, tribal members will kind of pop in and out of the convenience store and purchase what's available there. So it seemed like a really good opportunity to catch people where they're already shopping.
So does the grant help pay for the healthier foods that will be provided at the randomly assorted convenience stores? And do you have to have the cooperation, I assume, of certainly of the tribal leaders, but also of, I guess you could say, the store managers, if you will?
We do. We've actually had a tremendous amount of support from both tribal nations in embarking upon these efforts. They helped us plan the grant, design it, offered very strong letters of support, and this project is a little bit different than traditional research because it's what we call community-based participatory research. So rather than having the researchers sort of design the questions and collect all of the data and interpret it ourselves, we are actually involving community members at every stage of the research. So in the development of the research questions, they're collecting the data with us, planning data collection methods, interpreting the data with us, as well as even publishing and disseminating the findings. So this participatory approach really values community member knowledge equally with academic knowledge. And we feel that community members know best what is likely to work in their communities and have a lot to offer to the research process.
So I noticed, too, that you mentioned how community-based participatory research is a bit unusual, although I think in many ways the NIH is moving in that direction with what they call translational research. That is, they're really trying to get science much more out into the clinical world and the community, because too often it gets locked up in ivory towers and labs and things. But you also have this third aim of Thrive, which is creating a multimedia manual, website, and documentary film. And that, I would say, is very unusual for an NIH-funded project, a documentary film. Can you tell us what you're thinking about in that regard?
Sure. I should probably say a little bit about my background and kind of how I got interested in public health. I come from a family. I'm biracial, so my mother is white and my father is Native American. He's Choctaw. And so I sort of grew up understanding kind of the value of diversity and sort of that different populations and different cultures look at the world and understand the world really differently. I probably know that at a cellular level, I think, having grown up in my household. And so I think that what documentary film does is it actually captures story. And story is traditionally the way that Native people have understood the world. And so while sort of Western world uses science, and it's an incredible tool to understand and think about the world, Native people have always used story. And so I think I was always interested in story. You know, it was the way that I kind of learned about my heritage and learned about who I am. And it just was a natural progression with my work as I was kind of moving on and learning about public health and learning about research. You know, I wanted to include the process of understanding about the world through story that I knew really spoke to Native people.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa on Health. I'm John Schumann, sitting in for Rich Fisher today. Our guest is Valerie Bluebird Jernigan, who is an assistant professor of public health at the University of Oklahoma Health Sciences Center. She's also a filmmaker, a researcher, and we're talking about her NIH-funded project called Thrive. Valerie, you mentioned your interest in telling stories through the Native tradition. Do you consider yourself, well, you said you're biracial, and you perhaps have a foot in both worlds, but are you more of a scientist as someone who holds a doctorate in public health, or more of a storyteller, or is your goal to blend the two?
So I think I wear three hats, really. I think that I wear the hat of an academic and an artist and an activist. And I think that all of those three things really go together actually really well. The type of research that I do, which is community-based participatory research, uses research combined with action for social change. And so It makes it really easy to use research as a tool to kind of empower communities and give communities the opportunity to tell their stories.
Did you develop your interest in filmmaking first, and then it led to the sort of academic interest of using documentary film as a powerful teaching tool, or vice versa, or was it more just organic and one thing led to another? I'm really intrigued by the idea, by the way, of documentary film in public health. And I think that that's, you know, something that just on its face is very powerful.
It is. I think it's really interesting. And I think the ways that it can be used are still being kind of explored, because film is such a new medium. And especially now with film being so accessible, anybody can make a video now. You can record a video from your phone. It used to be an art that was really reserved for kind of white, rich men. And now, you know, it's kind of democratized to where, you know, like I said, anybody can access an opportunity to make a video from their, even their smartphones. So I grew up never thinking, you know, I was going to become a scientist. I was an art major, a writer, a photographer, and, you know, I did well in school. I liked science, but it was never something that I thought that I would pursue for a job until after graduating with a degree in anthropology. I knew I wanted to go on to graduate school, but I wasn't really sure what I wanted to do. But I knew that I wasn't interested in just kind of observing or watching communities. What I hoped to do was intervene on some of the factors that I felt were creating injustice. I wanted to do something that would help create more equality. And I got interested in public health because it was one of the graduate programs that University of Oklahoma offered, and I went to kind of explore the possibility of enrolling in the School of Public Health, and I actually interviewed with a researcher, Dr. Elisa Lee, who at the time was leading the largest study on Native American cardiovascular disease that's ever been conducted, the Strong Heart Study. And she really became one of my first mentors, because she actually brought me into the research study, and I really learned traditional research methods during my MPH. One of the things that was really fascinating to me about the experience was that I showed up on my first day of work kind of expecting that I would be surrounded by other Native American researchers, and I was actually just the only one, and I was a student to boot. So I thought that that was really surprising, and it made me really curious about the lack of Native researchers exploring kind of public health questions. And I knew also that it was really, really important. I mean, traditional research is really important. It tells us a lot about what factors were causing disease in Native communities. Do Natives live as long? Do Natives die at higher rates? That sort of thing. But the critical factor that was missing was really the Native voices at the table. And so through this kind of traditional research training, I became really interested in participatory research. And that led me to California and to UC Berkeley. That's where I started to mesh the worlds of film and public health, and it came together a little bit there.
So you have a film that you just completed, a documentary called 40 Winters. And for listeners that are interested, they can see the trailer for that on your website, 40wintersdocumentary.com. And 40 Winters tells the tale of a Native American activist who was present at the American Indian Movement's occupation, I guess is the term, of Alcatraz Island, that had been the site of course, the famous prison that was closed down. And I guess the island was left fallow. And You know, I think many of our listeners probably aren't even aware of the American Indian Movement, or if they are, it's a long time ago. Could you sort of share with us some of the broad details and then what your film is trying to, the stories that your film is trying to tell?
Sure. Before the late 1960s, Native people were essentially restricted to reservations and then encouraged to move to cities and assimilate. And with the civil rights movement that was starting in the 60s, Native Americans also started to develop their own sort of American Indian movement. And a lot of people believe, and I agree, that the beginning origins of the American Indian movement, it really was the Indian occupation of Alcatraz Island, which started in 1969 and lasted about 2 years. And during that time, Native people, the occupation really raised a lot of awareness around the plight of American Indians. Nobody really knew much about, you know, Native people, where we lived. Our history wasn't taught in school. And, you know, the only thing people knew about us was through the old John Wayne Westerns. And that certainly wasn't telling kind of a pretty story about Native people. So the occupiers all of a sudden had the media's attention, and this movement sort of began to kind of reclaim tribal lands and identity, and that's what the occupation was about.
And so 40 winters later, one of the activists, the man who at the time I think you told me he was 19 and helped or was responsible for putting up the teepee on Alcatraz Island, you revisited him in the context of his family, and you have this film now, I guess, going out on the festival circuit. Tell us a little bit about the film.
The film is called 40 Winters, and it follows the story of Robert Free, who was one of the original activists on the island. Back in 69, he put the teepee up, and that teepee became the symbol of the American Indian occupation. So 40 years later, he sort of sets upon this journey to put the teepee back up on the island to commemorate the 40th anniversary of the island and to reignite the spirit of the movement and to kind of ask some of those questions that were raised 40 years ago, kind of who are Native people, you know, have we achieved the things that we set out to achieve? Has the movement resulted in the kind of equality that we were searching for? So the film follows Robert's journey through the process of putting this teepee back up, and he encounters many obstacles. Ironically enough, one of the obstacles is the island is now a bird sanctuary to these birds who have only recently migrated there. And so he gets into several fights with a
Park Service Ranger, or?
It's not Park Service Ranger. He gets into some disagreements with kind of local environmentalists. And so that's one obstacle that he encounters. He also encounters kind of problems with the Park Service having designated the land as historical preservation land, and so there are issues like that. Some of the interesting aspects of the film include Robert's personal family dynamics, children of activists. You know, in his case, his kids paid a price for his activism, and so some of that comes out in the film.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa on Health. I'm John Schumann, sitting in for Rich Fisher today. My guest is Valerie Bluebird Jernigan, who's an assistant professor of public health at the University of Oklahoma Health Sciences Center. She's also a documentary filmmaker and researcher and activist. And we're talking about her recently completed documentary, 40 Winters, that revisits the story of the American Indian occupation of Alcatraz Island 40 years after 1969. On your website, 40wintersdocumentary.com, there are a couple of shorts that are wonderful. The one called Carver features a gentleman named Charles Elliott, who is just that. He carves beautiful native masks and artwork. And he said something in that short that I wanted to ask you about. He said, taking your art and your language back is a form of activism. And it sounded like as a young man, he really was maybe a little bit lost, didn't know exactly what he wanted to do, but got exposed to another carver, maybe a mentor, and he just apprenticed himself, and this became his life. He said, I took one look and knew that this was what I wanted to do. And just in, I think, a less than 4-minute film, it's very powerful.
He's a wonderful artist who is bringing back the traditional carving practice of the Coast Salish people. That's where that's his tribal kind of affiliation and where he lives. And he definitely captures that experience really well in his film. I think that you're seeing a resurgence of Native people reclaiming our identity. You can see that here with these beautiful films that they're PSAs that the tribes, Choctaw and Chickasaw Nation, actually show. You think about the Chickasaw Nation, you know, public service announcements. They air, you know, on television, and they're beautifully produced, and they focus on highlighting the contributions that Chickasaw people have made and make currently to Oklahoma society. You know, we're doctors, we're lawyers, we're artists, and we're part of the community. And it does a lot to, you know, I think, counteract all the damage that was done with the John Wayne Westerns and the stereotypes of Native people that were portrayed and reinforced for so long. And to have a tribe say, you know, this is who we are, and this is how we're part of this society. And I think it just, I remember seeing the first one I've ever, you know, the first one I ever saw, I was just shocked. Wow, that is really something.
I've seen those. They are amazing, yeah. Powerful. There's another short you have at 40wintersdocumentary.com. It's called The New Frontier, and it's also very short. And it tells the story, Laverne Roberts tells her own story, really, of migration from the reservation to the city. And there are just so many ironies in such a short film. Like, A New Frontier, of course, was, I guess, what the Kennedy administration was called. And embedded in this documentary are Department of the Interior films, which I guess is the Bureau of Indian Affairs is in the Interior Department. So it's really right. An Indian service film. And it has that kind of omniscient narrator, that kind of stentorian white male voice talking about Native Americans on the reservations actually overpopulating the reservations, that, you know, in this sort of almost pastoral scene, they are shepherds, they're caring for some sheep, but that the threat of overpopulation means they're going to go hungry, and so it's thus very important that they move to the city in this kind of promotional, almost propaganda type of way, encouraging. I guess my question is, who is that Bureau of Indian Affairs film? Is it, I guess it's aimed at both Native audiences to try to convince them, but also to the general public to talk about what a good thing assimilation will be or moving to the city? And then, of course, the painful story of Ms. Roberts, who, you know, says to her kids eventually, you know, I want to move back to the reservation. Will you come with me? And they say, no, this is our home in the city. I mean, it just, again, like 5 or 6 minutes, incredibly powerful. It's great filmmaking. So who was this propaganda? Who was this propaganda aimed at?
That film was really fun to make because I got to put my hands on this old BIA, Bureau of Indian Affairs, footage. And, of course, it was aimed at Native people to get Native people to move into the cities with the hope that if we moved into the cities, that we would assimilate and we would disappear and that we, you know, would avail ourselves of the urban, you know, local services, and we would no longer be, we would no longer have access to the rights that we had from the treaties. And so that was the idea with the assimilation, you know, the termination and relocation movement of the 50s through the 70s that occurred. And so, yeah, that was a really fun movie to make because it was just great seeing that old footage, that propaganda footage. But everything is really, I mean, everything is really some form of propaganda or another. I mean, even the stories that we're told about ourselves through scientific data, you know, that tells a story. You know, one of the fascinating experiences that I've had, you know, I had training as a researcher was being involved in a study where we told the Native youth, okay, you are the number one in smoking rates in the country, and thinking that that would, you know, deter them from smoking or help them to, you know, not pick up that first cigarette. And they actually responded with, well, that's great. At least we're number one in something. And so, you know, I think that that really kind of let me know that, you know, all form of scientific data tells some kind of story.
I think you're absolutely right about that. I hate to say it, but we're out of time. This has been a fascinating interview. Valerie Bluebird Jernigan is an assistant professor of public health at the University of Oklahoma Health Sciences Center. She is an NIH-funded investigator with a project called Thrive that is using community-based participatory research to study the impact of healthy food as an intervention in tribal convenience stores in Oklahoma. She's also a documentary filmmaker who just completed work on a film called 40 Winters that will be going around the film festival circuit. Valerie Bluebird Jernigan, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, that's our show for today. Studio Tulsa on Health is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. Opinions of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of KWGS or the University of Tulsa. If you've missed a recent show, you can listen anytime on our web archive. Just go to our website at publicradiotulsa.org and click on Studio Tulsa. I'm John Schumann, sitting in for Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.